Steve, thanks very much. One of our favorite comedians has returned. Rich Scheidner is here. He's doing comedy at Zany's all this week. Go to zanys.com. But tonight, Rich, a very special show.
Yeah.
Very different from anything that's ever been done at Zany's. Tell everybody what you're doing.
I'm doing a show on the history of stand-up comedy.
How cool is this? I'm sorry. Yeah. I like to learn stuff.
7 o'clock, the history of seven. Yeah, it just, it's, you know, I got, you know, I was involved with stand-up comedy my whole career.
Right.
And Phyllis Diller, I became friends with Phyllis Diller, and she was big on the history. I mean, she was into it.
Yeah. I loved and her. I want to like, be
you,
her.
Oh, she was great. She was great, man. She was really, you know, she was wild.
Out there.
Yeah, you know, yeah, but cool. She was the first female star stand-up comic. She broke through that way. I talk about her. I talk about the first a lot of people, like the first stand-up comic ever. It's an original American art form.
This started, I already
1861.
Know. 1861. 1861 was
guy.
The beginning of stand-up comedy.
A guy
comedy.
Named Artemus Ward out of Cleveland.
And
out
how did what Artemus Ward did back in 1861, how did that evolve into what we have today? Was it similar
at
all?
It was one person going on stage, one person facing an audience. Just the only purpose he had was to make them laugh. It was so radical because they used to do these lectures back then. Remember, this is no TV, no radio. So the entertainment, people go around and a lot of times, not plays or little dance things, but there were lectures, informative lectures. Right? They come and teach you something about the new continent of Australia or that slavery was bad or drinking was bad.
Yeah, sure.
Right? And then he says, I'm going to go up and do one of these lectures, but I'm just going to make them laugh as long as I can, as hard as they can. That's all I'm going to do.
So when Artemus Ward in 1861 said, what part of the chicken are the McNuggets? Did people have any idea what he was talking about?
He had, you know, look, a lot of his jokes obviously were, like he did jokes of the day. The jokes don't travel in time like music
right,
does.
Of course.
Right? But he had jokes that, so he said, we must all learn to live within our means, even if we have to borrow money to do so. So it's still funny.
Yes.
Right? I mean, he had jokes that were funny, but he had jokes that you have heard these things before, but you didn't know this was his joke. He said, if a man says it's not the money the thing, but the principle of the thing, it's the money of the thing.
Wow. Wow.
That was his.
It's a lot for 1861.
You have that material because it's curious to know what some of the first jokes were.
Yeah. So he would go on stage and he'd do this, and young people, right? This is the beginning of the war, Civil War. He was an immediate hit. I mean, he was a huge star then.
And because it was different?
It was so different, radical. But older people didn't dig it because they'd come out of the lecture to go, yeah, I laughed, but I didn't learn anything.
Oh.
It's a silly waste of time.
Yeah.
It was radical. See, comedy was only a little part of anything. If you did a little play or something, do a little bit. But the thoughts back then, if you were laughing, you were laughing at somebody, and the laugh too much was being rude. So he really broke through and did something that was totally radical.
And where would he do this, Rich? Because comedy clubs, obviously.
No. He did it in theaters all over.
Horse stables.
Sometimes. Really. He did a Wild West tour during the Civil War because it got so bad back east, you know, that people couldn't even laugh. The Civil War got so bad by 63, 64. So he went out west, right, to the Wild West, truly Wild West. And he would do these mining camps and all. This guy comes and he says, I want to do this mining camp. And he goes, there's nobody here. He says, well, once we light the bonfire, they'll all know something's happening down here. So, you know, it's like he went to some weird, wild places.
When did it become considered an art form where people would say, we're going to seek out comedy? Was that around the turn of the century?
Well, vaudeville comedy started moving in the theaters in vaudeville. You know, that was because back after Artemus Ward was doing it. You know, and he died in England. England is the one that when he went over to England, they said, this is an original American art form. We've never seen anything like this. They flipped for him. He died there, tuberculosis, when he was 32.
Oh, God. Man.
And they had a state funeral for him. I mean, royalty came. They flipped for this guy. And after that, there was really nobody doing it. You know, Twain was doing the lecture thing, like the Ward was doing. And he had a big name as a writer, so he could draw people. But most comics were trying to do it in saloons, and you really couldn't do it in a saloon. Saloons were really just brothels with men in them and drinking. And you know, they'd really shoot guns off if they didn't like you or throw stuff at the stage.
Wow.
So there were teams that would hit each other with sticks. That's how slapstick came into being.
Yeah.
They would just beat on each other for entertainment. That was basically...
That's the literal term.
Yeah, literal term.
Oh,
they would hit each other, you know, and...
It was a human version of the Punch and Judy puppet
show. Exactly.
But it was real people hitting each other.
Exactly. So slapstick, but so there wasn't what we call stand-ups doing the saloons too much. It just didn't work. Vaudeville opened up, and they wanted a family entertainment, bring everybody in.
And was it happening in other countries simultaneously?
No,
or was it strictly
US? No. You know, we have, I think, because we have the First Amendment, we have freedom of speech.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. You know, in England, they would shut you down if they didn't like what you were saying.
Sure.
Okay? So we had that here. We were also a new country, and so our culture wasn't locked in. Everything was changing and new, and we were evolving fast.
Right.
And also, I think because America's always loved that rugged individual thing. Like, that's a part of our mythology. Like, one person going out there and doing something, accomplishing something.
Sure.
You know, Charles Lindbergh or whatever, you know. And so I think that was part of it, too. That we always like to watch one person up there really going for it.
Yeah. Right.
This component of your work, where you talk about the history of stand-up, this is a relatively new thing, right? You just started this
in Los
Angeles?
About 10 years ago, I started really researching it.
Yeah.
You know, before Phyllis Diller died, and I got into it, and I found Artemus Ward through reading Twain stuff. Mm-hmm. He talked about him, and so I started, okay, let me look at all these people, like how, you know, because some of these people when I was young, you know, guys like Milton Berle. Now, people might not remember Milton Berle, but he was the first big star on television and a huge stand-up. But he was an old man when I came along.
Yeah.
So I thought, you see somebody, think they're always an old man. You never imagine them being young, right? But when he was young, he used to get thrown out of vaudeville for working dirty, what we called dirty, right? But it wasn't really dirty today. Do you want to hear one of the jokes he got thrown out for?
Yeah. Am I going to have to use the dumb button?
Not at all. So here's a joke. He said, a girl said to me, "Are you looking at my knees?" I said, "No, I'm way above that." That got him tossed out of vaudeville, right? Right? Risque. He said, "I told this girl I like to take an experienced girl home." She said, "I'm not experienced." He said, "You're not home yet." That got him tossed out. So he was a young guy, like 20, 22 years old, doing this stuff in vaudeville. He was pushing the edge, you know?
Yeah.
Comics have to go over the line to find the line, right? So that's what he was doing. And every generation has that happen.
What about the line now? Because things have changed.
I watched Dave Chappelle, and I love watching him move that line around, man. I mean, they go after it. I mean, you can't say, like people talk about being politically correct as like a problem with comedy,
mm-hmm.
but it's always been that way. Always been that way. Back in vaudeville time, people used to mock each other, you know, back in the early part of the 20th century, because of immigrants, right? So they would mock each other. They called all the Irish jokes were about Irish being drunks, and the Jewish jokes were about being cheap or that sort of thing. So they had, in Cleveland, the Jewish religious leaders and the Catholic Church got together to protest vaudeville comics. So that's political correct back then.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't like that they were doing all these ethnic jokes. Back in this is like 1900s, like 1905, 1906, they had these protests.
But did it change anything?
No, because people were laughing. As long as people are, you can say whatever you want as long as people are laughing.
Right? There is an article in the Hollywood Reporter this week that talks about a civil war in comedy right now, and they pointed at the situation with Shane Gillis, the guy that got hired by Saturday Night Live,
right,
and then 4 days later got fired.
Right.
So they said on one side of the line in the civil war of comedy are comedians who say, it's freedom of speech, and that's why we do this. On the other side, it's people saying there are elements of that, but it's just a guy being racist for the sake of being racist. There's no humor involved. Where do you stand on this?
The marketplace will shake it out. I'm for freedom of speech.
Yeah.
So the marketplace will shake it out. There, you know, if you're racist and people understand it, there are comics who will form for racist crowds. You don't think, like, every group has a comedian.
Yeah.
Right? Every group has a comedian. So you don't think the KKK have comedians come and perform for them?
Yeah.
But, I mean,
I'm
but
sure they're funny.
Right. But you know what I'm saying? I mean, I'm just saying you can't stop it. Can't stop it. But the marketplace will shake it out. That's my
Should
feeling.
He have been fired from Saturday Night Live, do you think?
You know,
it's a hard call, isn't it?
It's a hard call. A hard call. Whether you know, again, and I'm not sure if it wasn't that it wasn't racist at the time. I think a lot of times we make this like say the Kate Smith thing, right? Remember the Kate Smith
thing? God bless America.
Right. So they go, she did
Kate Smith. You
Kate
mean?
Smith. Yeah.
Bill.
Well, she did. Okay. Oh, she did a song. I guess it was a darky song or something like that.
Horrible.
Horrible, right?
It was horrible.
By today's standards. But back then, it wasn't considered bad. I mean, we're judging people culturally by things that were like years ago.
And now, we've evolved.
Hopefully. Right? But how can we expect them to evolve 90 years ago?
But this guy,
at that time,
Shane Gillis, his comments were from
this
a year
was
ago.
Recent. I'm just saying, that's recent. So it's a different situation.
I didn't watch it. You watched it. And, you know, like those roasts, I'm not a roast girl because I'm offended, but I'm laughing. And if it's funny, I'm sorry, it's funny. Laughing is a reaction that just comes out of you. So if it's funny, it's going to get a reaction. This wasn't funny, you said.
No, no, that's the problem, and I agree with you. It wasn't. And again, I agree with you on the roast. Those roast things are brutal. They're brutal, man, and they're meant to be.
Yes,
right.
You know what you're getting.
Exactly. So I'm just saying that's the marketplace. If I'm paying money to go see a roast, I should expect, you know,
raunch.
To be pushed. Exactly. Raunch, to push, to be offensive. That's what you're paying for. So I think the marketplace shakes it out. But in a public forum, and again, once you get out, you know this as well as I do, better than I do, you get advertisers involved, you have to run a different line. You're running a different operation. So Saturday Night Live is a different operation.
And we were talking about this, too. If you're paying money to go to a club to see this guy, Shane Gillis, do his act, you are either familiar with him or you've chosen to go. Putting him on, you know, national TV on your television every night, then you don't have a choice.
Exactly. It's a whole different operation. And if I don't know. I haven't talked to him. I don't know him. Mm-hmm. I don't know how he feels about it or what happened there. But yeah, it's all content. I think, look, I used to tell stories, and I got heckled. I got heckled. This was a story I told. Mm-hmm. I got heckled in Beaumont, Texas, when I first started.
Mm-hmm.
I was down there working in Houston, 1981. They fly me over to Beaumont. I'm doing this show, and this guy sitting down front, this is the early part of the comedy boom, right? And he says, do some N jokes, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm like taken aback, because I mean, it's not like I have never heard the word before, but I've never heard anybody yell that out in public mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
So I try to slide off it when I came back. I said, listen, man, I think everybody should laugh at their own kind. I mean, let black people laugh at black people, and Jewish people do Jewish jokes. That's why I laugh at a-holes. That's how I got out of it. Right? I slide it out. Mm-hmm. Right? I think I'm doing a little depth. He comes right back. He's not letting up. Like, he's young. Dude, I said, dude, like, I'm not prepared. Like, I didn't come prepared.
Yeah, wow.
Don't you have any jokes?
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
So it's a whole thing. Now, I've told that story. This actually happened. So I told that story one time, right? And a guy, I used the N-word. I used it.
Yeah.
And quoting the guy in the club.
Yeah.
Right? So another guy heard me say that, and he tells somebody it was on social media. He goes, you know, Scheidner's a racist. I heard him use the N-word. You see what I mean? He took what I said out of context.
Yeah.
And slammed me for it.
Yeah.
So you got to understand sometimes, you know, my lesson from that was I don't use the word at all now.
Yeah,
even quoting
Safe
that guy,
yep.
right?
Because I got whacked for it in that way.
All right, Rich, hold that thought. Rich Scheidner's here. He's performing at Zanies all this week. Tonight, a special show. It's the history of comedy. Go to Zanies.com. We'll pick this up in a minute. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder, and it's WGN. Rich Scheidner's here. He's performing at Zanies all this week. Tonight, a very special show. It's a lecture. I guess you qualify this as a lecture, right, Rich?
It's a show. It's funny. I mean, I got great funny stories, and you heard some of the material. I mean, I do material from comics all through the ages, all the way through, and they're funny. They're funny. I picked out the ones that could still work today.
Has anyone influenced stand-up comedy more than George Carlin and Richard Pryor? Those are the two biggies,
Recent one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, a lot of people. A lot of people. Every time, every generation, somebody's new. Bob Hope influenced comics back then.
Sure.
Jack Benny influenced comics back then. There's comics today who are in the line of other people, right, who, I mean, I'm sure Bill Burr is influencing comics right now.
No question.
But he is the New York wise guy kind of character of a guy named Frank Fay who influenced Bob Hope, influenced, again, you look at Jay Leno or David Letterman, they were like New York wise guys.
Yeah.
And then Bill Burr. So it all goes through the line. I mean, people are influenced by other people.
We got a couple of texts. Now, you mentioned Phyllis Diller, who is my idol. I want to be the Phyllis Diller of the 2000s. I need to work on it a little more. Yeah. But 773 says, Moms Mabley did stand-up before Phyllis Diller.
Absolutely. I said Phyllis Diller was the first female stand-up star. And Moms was also relegated to the black circuit. She couldn't. She worked in the black vaudeville and then in what they called the Chitlin circuit of comedy clubs and theaters in the black circuit. She didn't work white audiences even getting allowed to get in front of white audiences until like the late 60s, 70s.
Unreal.
And Dick Gregory here in Chicago broke the color line. He was sort of the Jackie Robinson of stand-up comedy. He became the first black comic to work in front of white audiences here at the Playboy Club back in 60.
Also, Lenny Bruce doesn't get enough credit for what he did for stand-up, like influencing Pryor and Carlin, as you mentioned.
Well, did he? I mean, I said comics have to go over the line to find the line, but Lenny went so far over the line, he didn't know where the line was. I mean, he was out there, and of course, I mean, I talk about his, I have a different take than most people in terms of what he really was got in trouble for. In terms of, they said he got in trouble for, and what they were arresting for was obscenity, you know, using four-letter words and other words in the nightclubs. But that's not really what they went after him for, and I talk about that, and I talk about Lenny. I mean, he was a very funny guy. He was a funny guy. I mean, he broke down. Remember the mother-in-law jokes? They were all big in the 40s and 50s.
Sure.
Mother-in-law jokes, right? Because most of the time, mother-in-laws were living with you. There were multi-generational families going home, so that's why they were so popular. And it started to change, but Lenny, early in his career, he flipped the mother-in-law joke. I mean, he really pretty much destroyed it with one joke. He said, yeah, because all comics would say how tough it was to have mother-in-laws. You know, they were paying the butt, and they were destroying their marriage. And Lenny said, yeah, my mother-in-law, she ruined our marriage. My wife came home from work early and found us in bed one night.
One of the saddest aspects about him, Lenny Bruce, was at some point later in his career, when he would take to the stage, he wasn't doing stand-up anymore. He was just talking about his legal troubles.
It happens to comics. And Mort Saul would get involved in the Warren Report, you know, talking about the Kennedy assassination. You get lost. They start forgetting what their mission is up there. Like, you're licensed to get up there. My license to be up there is to be funny.
Right.
When I stop being funny, my license is revoked.
Yeah.
Right. They're there to hear you laugh and hear you joke. And Lenny got caught up in talking about his trial. He started fighting them on their terms and forgot that his sense of humor was his weapon.
Yeah.
That was his weapon. And he dropped his weapon and started trying to fight him on legal terms.
Right.
It was sad, yeah.
Who doesn't get their credit that is so due to them? Who in the world of comedy has influenced
the
so
most
many?
Underrated?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a guy from my generation that I think was so funny, and I don't think people have seen him as being funny. How funny he was Gilbert Gottfried.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about this Sunday night. I did this show in Los Angeles. I did the show I'm doing tonight in Los Angeles Sunday night, and the place was packed with comics. And so somebody asked me that question, and I was like kind of stunned because I hadn't thought about who was really underrated, right? And there was a guy named Ricky Craig Jr. from Vaudeville who wrote for Bob Hope. He died young of tuberculosis, and he kind of invented some joke forms. But then somebody said, how about Gilbert Gottfried? I thought, oh, Gilbert was so funny.
Absolutely.
I mean, in New York, nobody wanted to follow him.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to follow him. I mean, there was a paying spot. Like, you wanted money so bad.
Yeah.
Right? And it was like $25 on the weekend. It was like $25. My rent was $115, man, right? This is like 1979 in New York. And people would just cancel all the time. They go, oh, I got the spot after Gilbert. They wouldn't even show.
Right.
So I started taking that spot, but you couldn't follow him. He had a character called Tony, a Brooklyn comic. He put this really cheesy jacket on. And he turned around and he goes, and he started hitching his pants. He goes, hey, all right, yeah, all right, okay, here we go. All right, with the jokes. Why did the chicken cross the road? And he cursed like crazy. Who cares? It was a chicken. Right? He's throwing an F-bomb in between everything, you know.
Yeah.
And he goes, hey, why'd the moron throw the clock out the window? Because he's a moron. Right? And he was deconstructing comedy. He was like just taking jokes apart. So if you want to up after him and just try to do regular stand-up.
Impossible.
They look at you like, and then we just
impossible.
Saw Tony, you know.
Yeah.
But he did something. He'd take a bar stool and hold it up to his waist with the bar stool, the bottom sticking out, right? And he'd call it Quadra D.
Yeah.
Quadra D. And he'd do a parody. It was a movie like Jaws. He goes, you know, and he'd do all these characters talking about this creature killing people in the seaside. And just because Jaws was a big movie in the
70s.
Sure. Yeah.
But you couldn't, and he's doing all these compressions within the characters. And
so original.
It was so original.
Original.
He was so original, man.
We only
have
a couple seconds.
He did, first guy I ever saw, he'd take a piece of rope, hold it behind his head and go, mental floss. Mental floss.
Through the years.
Right? And now I've heard that thing a million
sure.
times.
People talking
about mental floss, right?
Yeah.
That was Gilbert.
We have a minute, but I want to throw another name at you that I always consider the most underrated comic I've ever seen, Robert Klein. I just think he's...
Oh, you know what?
He's brilliant.
He influenced my generation as much as anybody.
Yeah.
You want to talk... That's a good point.
Yeah.
I saw him in 1974 at American University This is the truth. I fell out of the bleacher.
Yeah.
I was in bleacher. It was at a bleacher. The gymnasium was packed, right, in American University. And I was laughing so hard, I slipped under. I slipped, you know, you fall down. I fell
oh,
down.
Yeah.
I fell. I couldn't control myself laughing.
Yeah.
He was the funniest guy.
So good. And he could come at you with so many different directions.
You know, he'd made smart comedy okay.
Yes.
I mean, he was like a college-educated guy, and he made no bones about it. I mean, he did, you know, references that were collegiate, really.
Yep.
I mean, he made it okay, because before that, comics were like, you'd hide the fact you were. There's a funny story, you know, Bob Newhart's from here, right? So
love
Bob
him.
Newhart was a Loyola graduate.
Yeah.
Right? Loyola graduate. So they're doing after he made it big, and he was huge, right? Early 60s when he broke big with his album. They're doing a talk show, David Susskind, one of those early 60s talk show, and Buddy Hackett and some of these old school comics are on the show, right, with this young Bob Newhart. And so the interviewer brings out that Bob Newhart is a college graduate, and Buddy Hackett, like, he goes, you could see him on the show, he goes, what? You're a college graduate? You mean you don't have to do this? Like, they were, like, stunned. You don't have to do this stupid stuff?
That's perfect. Rich, it's always good to see you.
Thank you.
This sounds great.
Yeah.
I hope. I wish you guys could come. I know you work and everything, but early. But
this sounds so much fun. It's now this part, the History of Comedy, is only tonight.
Just tonight.
Regular stand-up the rest of the week. Uh-huh. Go to zanies.com. All the information is there. Thanks, Rich.
My pleasure.
Thanks,
gentlemen,
Wendy.
Not the Ramones. he was saying how
you love that story. You
yes,
still got
You know, he opened up for the Ramones just to get your $50.
Yeah.
So closing for Gilbert Gottfried. Just do it to take the money.
Just
hope you're making more now.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.